thank you for joining me this evening. We've got a night full of research and history and mysteries as we're talking about the lost tomb of King Arthur, the search for Camelot, the Isle of Avalon through this hour. Then Andrew Collins joins us in the next 2 hours of the show to discuss Atlantis in the Caribbean and the comet that changed the world. That's what's going on. And you can go check out what's going on at coasttocoastam.com. Go check out the website now. Some great information up there. There's a video of a man possessed at a Malaysian grocery store and a rare ice disc filmed in Russia. There's also some other interesting bits in the news. Slender Man in the movies, a huge fossil deposit that was found in Antarctica, and a girl that's been hassled by police for using a $2 bill. Not a $2 bill, yes, a $2 bill. You can go read those stories and so much more. Go check it out on the site. And while you're there, check out our Insiders Club, because right now we've got a great deal going on for the month of May 2016. Only 99 cents to become a Coast Insider for the first month. So all that information is on the website. Go check it out for yourself. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, for the evening, and I host Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal talk radio, five nights a week, Monday through Friday, 9 to midnight Central Time. You can listen to our show and stream it live from our website at darknessradio.com. And then keep tuned in, because as soon as we wrap up from midnight till 4 a.m., George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues your journey. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to delve into more of the history and mystery of King Arthur. We now know that this king, this reported king, did exist. We have names that match. We know the histories and the locations of where King Arthur ruled. What about some of the other stories that surround him? The Knights of the Round Table, Merlin, the Holy Grail Quest, Excalibur. With us right now, we do have Graham Phillips. Graham, I'm just curious, before we go to the break, what about the Knights of the Round Table? I mean, that was such a fascinating aspect of the whole story, this kind of camaraderie, this brotherhood of men that joined together and would follow their king into the depths of hell. Do we know if this truly existed?
Well, the Knights of the Round Table, as they're portrayed in the romantic story, didn't exist in the historical Arthur period. I mean, they are always portrayed as knights in shining armor fighting with broadswords and lances. That was a medieval style of fighting. Those sort of people didn't exist back in 500 AD. The real King Arthur would have been a Roman-style soldier. They'd have worn Roman-style armor. And instead of living in great big castles, like Camelot is portrayed, they'd have lived in fortifications with earthen banks and timber stockades around them. So it would have been very different. But the possibility that the Knights of the Round Table existed in some form is that the Celtic warriors of Britain at the time Arthur is said to have lived used to, when they met, they used to sit in a circle around a cauldron, which would be bubbling some kind of brew that they'd all share together. And the idea was that as it was a circle, nobody could be seated at the head of the table. So that if you've got a load of separate kings of different areas sitting at a circle, no one could say, I'm more important than the other. And I think this was where the theme of the round table came from, that in medieval times, of course, was an actual physical table with knights sitting around it. So, yes, I believe there would have been warriors of a circle, if you like, that became the Knights of the Round Table in legend.
Did knights like Lancelot and Galahad exist? I know that you said in the romanticized poems they came up with the term Camelot for the town so that it would rhyme with Lancelot. Does that mean that Lancelot was also a work of fiction?
Lancelot himself, there's two possibilities. One, Lancelot was already a character in his own right and had all his own stories written about them, and he was like added on. It's sort of like now in the DC comics, you get Batman added onto Superman, and then you get the Green Arrow coming in, all separate figures, all associated with the same saga. So Lancelot may have been added from outside, but back at the time Arthur is said to have lived, there was a mythical hero, possibly based on some ancient god, whose name was Lud of the Silver Lance. Lancelot, Silver Lance. It's a possibility that Lancelot may really have originally been some sort of mythical hero that was added onto the Arthur story in very very early times. But one of the characters we'll talk about in a minute, as you said, is Merlin, and he really does seem to have existed.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and find out about the magic man himself, Merlin, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back on Coast to Coast AM with guest Graham Phillips in the search for King Arthur's lost tomb. And finding out a lot of the history of this man matches up to true history that we can find. As a matter of fact, our guest has talked about in the last hour the fact that King Arthur was a real man, was somebody that he was able to find. And although he was originally known as Owen Sanguine, his fighting or battle name would have been Arthur, which stood for the bear, and Ursus the bear. Fantastic stories, great research and history to dig into this. But as we're looking at the different layers of these stories, we find that some may not be as rigid as Arthur himself in history. But what about Merlin? Merlin the magician, this magical wizard that we've all grown to know and love in the stories of Camelot. What can you tell us about the reality of this man?
Well, when I was looking into the various myths and legends associated with Arthur, one of the ones that I thought was the least likely to have any basis in fact was Merlin. I mean, he's this magician, he's supposed to do all these amazing things. But it seems that he was indeed based on a real figure. Remember earlier I was talking about this man, Ambrosius Aurelius, who was the last of the Roman generals, if you like, who started to unite the British just before Arthur's time. Well, in the earliest references to Merlin, he is referred to as Ambrosius. And he acquired the name Merlin once he gave up being a ruler in his own right and became more of a mystic, a bard, as they call them then, which is a person who A, wrote poetry, and B, had the secret of herbal medicines and all sorts of other mystical properties, including supposedly the power of prophecy. So he gave up being a warrior to become this mystic. Now, the name Merlin is yet another of these honorary names. It means an eagle. In fact, there's still a bird of prey called a Merlin today. Now, this is another reason why a lot of these figures haven't been discovered before in history, because people have been looking for their real names and have forgotten about the tradition of being given titles of animals. Now, Merlin, it seems from what my research suggests that when Ambrosius stopped being leader of the Britons, we're not told he didn't die, he simply disappears from history. And at that same time, we've then got references to this wandering mystic called Merlin. Now, in the story of Arthur, Merlin is the real power behind the throne. It's him who gives Arthur the sword Excalibur. It's him who advises Arthur what to do and organize and teaches Arthur how to win battles. Now, if he was this real Ambrosius Aurelius, which I am convinced he was, then the fact that he was a Roman general, the last of the great Roman generals, and had a couple of legions under his command, then once he retired, he could have taught the historical Arthur exactly how to go about defeating the enemy. So, yes, Merlin seems to have been real.
All right, you mentioned Merlin, and you mentioned the gift of Excalibur. Now, this fascinating, and remember, again, this is the way I was brought, Sword in the Stone, the whole idea of a young Arthur being worthy and drawing that sword from the stone that had been plunged there during battle, waiting for the next worthy man to take control of the kingdom. What can you tell us about the legend of Excalibur?
Well, the first thing, and it's a misconception, is that the sword that was taken from the stone is not the same as the sword Excalibur. Arthur draws a sword from a stone in order to become king in the legend. He then is, when he becomes king, we're not told what happens to that sword afterwards, but when he becomes king, Merlin takes him to this mysterious nymph-like creature, this woman, this kind of half-mermaid, called the Lady of the Lake. And she is the one who forges and gives Excalibur to Arthur, and it allows him to be undefeated in battle. Now, the story of caliber is something that I thought, like Merlin, that's got to have been made up. But it seems not. It could have been based on real events, because in the story of Arthur, when he lies dying, he gives one of his knights Excalibur and he tells him to throw it into a nearby lake. And when he does so, the arm of the Lady of the Lake rises from the surface, grabs the weapon and takes it down into the crystal depths. I mean, that's the story. Historically, we know from Roman writers that the Celts of Britain had a practice that during a funeral of an important person, a king, their sword would be thrown into a sacred pool or lake as an offering to a water goddess. And the water goddess of the Celts at that time is known as Viviana. And the name of the Lady of the Lake in the Arthurian legends is Vivian. So in other words, the story of the Lady of the Lake probably came from a real practice of when Arthur was dying, when he died during his funeral rite, his sword was thrown into a sacred lake. And we know that this really happened because archaeologists have excavated the beds of dried up lakes that were sacred in Celtic times and have found that there are many precious items that have been thrown as offerings to a goddess for safe passage to the underworld or whatever. And amongst these are many swords. So the story of Excalibur could very well have come from that.
As we're talking about the famous legends, and we've talked about Lancelot and Galahad and the king and the knights of the Round Table, Excalibur, Merlin, what about the love of Guinevere? Was this just another machination for the love stories and the poems and the romantic fantasies that were created later on?
Well, Arthur does have a wife, and in the earliest references, she's actually called Ganumara. Guinevere seems to have been tagged onto the story at some point during the Dark Ages, when, remember, most of the stories were handed on by word of mouth. She seems to have been tagged on, was originally a goddess. The name Guinevere means white spirit or white lady, and she was an important goddess of the ancient Celts. And it seems that stories associated with her, she's, apart from being a goddess of healing, she's also a goddess of battle and a goddess of victory. So it seems that somewhere along the line, perhaps Arthur's dedication to this goddess became confused with his dedication to his wife. But sadly, we know very little about the women of Arthur's time, because history tends to only record what men did in those days.
Hence the term his story, right? Let's talk about the tomb. And I know we're going to open up phone lines for people that have questions for you. This is the big part of your book, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur and the Search for Camelot in the Isle of Avalon. You believe that Camelot was this large city, this town that he was in charge of. That was his Camelot. What can you tell us about the tomb? Has there been a tomb uncovered that seems to be pointing in all directions to actually being that of King Arthur?
Well, near the ruins of Viriconium, which I believe was his Camelot, which anyone can visit today, it's open to the public. You can see all the old walls that still survive. I looked into various records concerning that and found something which I think had been completely overlooked by previous historians. It's a manuscript that survives in the Library of Oxford University. And it's a war poem that was written in the early Dark Ages, somewhere around 650. And it refers to the burial site of those kings who ruled from Viriconium. And it talks about the first of them, Owen Sanguin, the man who I believe was Arthur, being buried at a place called the Churches of Bassa. Now, I looked at the map in the area around where Viriconium is, and just a few miles to the north, there is a village still today called Bath Church. Bath Church, Churches of Bassa, surely it had to be the same place. There's nothing anywhere around there that sounds anything like that. And just outside this village is a hillock that was once surrounded completely by a lake. Now some of that lake has dried up. but the hillock still survives, and it was fortified in the Dark Ages. Certain amount of archaeology that's been done there has shown that it was ringed with defensive embankments, and it seems to have been used for ceremonial purposes. And this ancient poem tells us that this is where the kings of Viriconium were buried, including Owain Llanguin. And Owain, it seems, according to the poem, was buried in an acre of land called Travail's Acre on this island in the middle of this lake. And there's only one place there that matches that description. And I managed to organize a geophysics survey. What that is archaeologists use state-of-the-art equipment like ground sensing radar to look under the soil and find out what's down there without the need to dig. And they discovered that right in the middle of this acre of land, which I believe is this Travail's Acre, there is signs that there was a pit dug, a circular pit, about 6 feet wide and 6 feet deep, which is exactly how people were buried, or important people of high status were buried 1,500 years ago in a circular pit. But what's fascinating is right in the middle of that pit is a metal object under the ground. And archaeologists believe that it might be a shield. And warriors at the time were buried lying on their side with a shield on their arm. So it fits exactly with a burial of the period Arthur existed, and it's in exactly the place that we're told that Owain Llanguin, the historical Arthur, was buried. So I think I found his tomb.
So you found the tomb, and in 2 minutes, I know it's a little bit of a cramped deal, but before we go to break, what's pretty exciting about this is you may have also located the final resting place for Excalibur. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that Arthur in the story of the Middle Ages is buried on an island called Avalon. And it's an island in the middle of a lake originally, not across the sea, in the middle of a sacred lake. Now, we know that this lake at Bath Church was in fact a sacred lake that was used for offerings at the time that Arthur is said to have lived. Now, in the story, Arthur seems to be, after Arthur's sword Excalibur is thrown into this lake, he's then sailed across to the island in that same lake to be buried. So if Arthur is buried on this, what was an island in the middle of this lake of Bath Church, then perhaps Excalibur lies in the lake that surrounds it. And I also managed to organize a forensic marine archaeological excavation of the lake, where a boat went up and down with special equipment and found that in that lake there appears to be some sort of gold object hidden in the silt at the bottom of the lake. It could be the gold handle of a sword. Now, we don't know this for certain, but the archaeologists organized for divers to go down there to see if they could retrieve it. But sadly, the water was just too murky, and there's about 4 feet of silt and mud on top of the actual bed of the lake. So at the moment, until we get better archaeological equipment, it's stuck there. So Excalibur could be at the bottom of this lake.
Unbelievable. I've got to guess you're going to be up for knighthood when all of this comes together and the definitive proof is there. When you find Arthur's body, you find Excalibur's hilt. This has got to be exciting news for you, Graham. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're opening up phone lines. We want to entertain your questions, thoughts, and concerns for our guests. So please feel free to give us a call and be a part of the show. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to Coast AM. Coming up next hour, Atlantis in the Caribbean and the comet that changed the world. Andrew Collins, our guest for the final 2 hours of Coast to Coast AM. We're opening up phone lines to you, our guest this evening, Graham Phillips, as we round out the lost tomb of King Arthur. I do have a question that came in through the email here, and it says, there's one thing wrong with your guest's hypothesis of the location of Avalon. According to legend and lore, it says that it is on the same site as Westminster Abbey. What does your guest make of this? And that comes from Jeff.
There are actually a number of places throughout Britain that have been associated with Avalon. During the Middle Ages, various authors decided, it might be at Glastonbury, which is in the southwest of England, or it might be down in the south of England, at places like Winchester, or it could be, as your questioner asked, somewhere in London. But the problem is that the reason why so many people in the Middle Ages kept coming up with different possible sites for Avalon is, A, the writers who were writing about them lived in those places, or the people who were paying for them to write their sponsors lived there, so there was a reason for them to perhaps bring that area in as a possible site of Avalon. But the trouble is that the earliest references from the Dark Ages don't tell us where it is. In fact, it has a number of names. Avalac appears to be in the original name, which means the Isle of Apples. And none of these early stories actually tell us where it is. The only thing that we are told is that it's on an island in a lake rather than across the ocean. Now, later stories do in fact refer to Avalon being across an ocean, but they seem to have been confusions of other lost islands that Avalon was the name given to all of them. But the only one that actually fits with the description that we are given of an island in a lake, that I can find anyway, that fits with the historical location where it seems Arthur came from, is this lake with this island in it, which is in the centre of England near Viriconium, at Bath Church. So I think possibly these other stories, such as that place Avalon all over the country, were probably invented during the Middle Ages.
Fair enough. Let's take our final break here. We'll come back. We'll start with your phone calls and our guest, Graham Phillips, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Graham Phillips, our guest this evening, as we talk about the lost tomb of King Arthur. Talk to me a little bit about the quest for the Holy Grail. I know that that's always been an aspect of the story that's been intriguing to me. How did that get tied into the Arthurian legends?
Well, originally, there was two objects referred to as the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail basically means an object that once held the blood of Jesus. Now, the story that's most popular is that the Holy Grail was the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, as described in the Bible. And one of Jesus' disciples, a man called Joseph of Arimathea, used this cup to collect a few drops of Jesus' blood during the crucifixion. And thereafter, this cup became endowed with amazing healing properties. And he eventually fled persecutions in Palestine and came to Britain. And somewhere in Britain, he hid that cup, that chalice. And many years later, King Arthur and his knights go searching for it. At least King Arthur's knights search for it because Arthur's ill and he needs to be cured. Now, that's the story that most people are familiar with. But that isn't the earliest story of the Holy Grail. The earliest Holy Grail says it was a small scent jar that belonged to one of Jesus's female followers, Mary Magdalene, and she had a scent jar when she went to the tomb after Jesus was laid in the tomb after the crucifixion. She went there with this scent jar to anoint his body with precious oils, which was the tradition at the time. But when she sees the risen Christ outside the tomb, he gives her some drops of his blood from the wounds in his hands that she collects in this ointment jar, and that then becomes the vessel which is endowed with a miraculous healing properties. Now, in the earliest stories, that is the Holy Grail. The reason why later it's more likely to be the Joseph of Arimathea one is because women tended to get cut out of stories during the Middle Ages, so that original story became less popular. But the way that got to Britain is that one of the first Christian Roman empresses, Helena, in the early 300s, she went to Jerusalem and collected a load of items that local Christians believed were associated with Jesus, this being one of them. And she took it to Rome. It was put on display in what later became the Vatican. When Rome was sacked by barbarians in 410 AD, this cup, along with a lot of other Roman treasures, was taken out of Rome and brought to the only place which was considered safe from barbarian invasions, which was the island of Britain. And that is how the Grail ends up in Britain, according to the earliest stories. Now, I managed to actually trace a family who claimed to have possessed this small chalice belonging to Mary Magdalene, known as the Chalice of Magdalene, and they handed it right the way down to people all the way through the 1900s, the 19th century. One of these guys in the 19th century hid this thing because he had no one to hand it on to. He had no children. Somebody else inadvertently found it in the 1920s, and I traced that man's great-great-granddaughter, and she still had it in an attic, all tied up with old newspaper. They didn't know what this thing was. They just thought it was some old cup that may have had some significance. And I said, can I borrow this? I took it to the British Museum, where they immediately identified it as a Roman scent jar dating from the first century. And from the stone it's made from green alabaster stone, the stone it's made from comes from the district of Palestine. So I actually got hold of a cup that came from the right place and the right time to have actually been associated with Jesus.
Wow.
So I don't know. Maybe I've actually had and drunk from the real Holy Grail.
Well, we'll know when you just continue to live and live and live, right?
Well, precisely. I'm still in 40 years. I think we can say I've found it.
Very good. Let's go to the wild card lines. Frank in Hollywood, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mr. Phillips? Something is your research is so fascinating, but off subject, the Ark of the Covenant. Where is it? I'm so fascinated by it. And a doctor from Ethiopia, he says it's buried in a field across from a church. Could you tell me what you know about it?
Well, my particular research into the Ark of the Covenant, which I did in a completely separate book, which was called The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant, suggests that the Knights Templars, the Crusader Knights in the Middle Ages, claimed to have found the Ark of the Covenant at a place called Petra, which is an old city, an old ruined city in Jordan, and they brought it back to England after the Crusades were over. That was that I was fascinated by, whether or not it was the Ark of the Covenant. It was a massive gold chest that they believed was. It was certainly worth looking for. And when the Knights Templars were eventually disbanded, they left a series of clues in a church in the middle of England near Stratford-upon-Avon, where Shakespeare comes from. And these clues, these paintings, were hidden behind plaster for centuries. And in around about 1900, the plaster was removed. These clues that were left on the walls of this church led me to a field a few miles away from there and the ruins of an old chapel. Now, we had that surveyed by a geophysics survey by archaeologists who found the remains of the chapel, but no Ark of the Covenant. But what was interesting is that that area was dug up when a road was laid in the 1950s, and the builder who was responsible for being in charge of the crew that did the work suddenly, from being fairly poor, became extraordinarily rich and built the biggest house in the county. Now, a few years ago, he died, and all record of where he got his money from or anything else disappeared. It's my theory that he found this golden chest and sold it, and I'm looking at the moment to whom he sold it to, or, well, the records of what happened to his family. And that is a pretty exciting quest that I'm on as we speak. So my belief is that it could be somewhere in the heart of England. It could have been sold to Americans. It could be in California, for all I know, but that's what I'm looking for.
Thank you for calling in, Frank. Let's go to east of the Rockies. We've got Jay in Florida. Welcome to the show. Jay, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, hi.
Great bumper music. I was surprised you didn't play House of the Rising Sun last night.
Yeah.
Okay, I had a few different things, so I'll let you pick if we have time to get to them. The one Donna liked the most was, and this was going to be my last choice, but I was wondering about Morgana, where she has been portrayed with some series as his sister and more of as a rival that's trying to, like, overthrow him and usurp and take over his power and his throne. So if there's any truth to that or if such a woman existed. And then he keeps referring to the Dark Ages. So, and I've heard about how the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church had the Bible during that time, in which, of course, you know, very little people knew how to read or write, and everything basically stopped and didn't progress until they were over. And then it was re-released back into the public, and, you know, they say it was edited and changed a great deal, especially the new...
All right, well, hold on. Before you get too extensive into that, let's go with the first couple of questions so we can try to get those in. What can you tell us about Morgana?
Morgana is now portrayed in the movies and the various TV series as this evil witch who is Arthur's sister, but she tries to take the throne, or generally cause trouble altogether. But interestingly, in the earlier stories that were written about her in the Middle Ages, she is a kindly enchantress. She is, in fact, a friend and colleague of the Lady of the Lake. They're both good white witches. Her original name was Morgan Le Fay, which means Morgan the Fairy. Of course, at that time, fairies weren't these little tiny creatures with gossamer wings like we imagine today, but human being-sized people who basically had magical powers. So originally, she is portrayed as being a kindly enchantress. And when Arthur is taken to Avalon, she is the one who tries to cure him. Some say that she put him into a sleep from which one day he will awake and re-rule the country. And others say that she failed and he was buried. So in the original stories, she's this kindly enchantress. But there is a Celtic goddess and a goddess of healing known as Morrigan. And it's possibly, again, like Guinevere, a goddess or a mythical figure who got tied into the Arthur story at a later date. On the second question of the Dark Ages and what the Vatican knows about things, well, once I was given a guided tour around the Vatican's secret archives, and I was expecting to find all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. But basically, the Vatican archives is actually more than it's cracked up to be, less than it's cracked up to be, because all I saw were boxes upon boxes upon boxes of invoices. So that's all I know about the Vatican secret archives.
All right, and can you encapsulate real quickly your last question for him, Jay?
Yes, I was wondering about the Knights of Templar, and they were supposed to protect, and their ties like to the occult and like secret societies, Illuminati, Freemasonry, or things that existed before then, equivalent to it and such.
I think a lot of people have said a lot of things about the Templars. They certainly became a very rich and powerful organization in the Middle Ages. And incidentally, in Germany, one of the first German Arthurian romances that was written talks about the Knights Templars as being the guardians of the Holy Grail. And all I know is that the family I said that had this cup, that I believe was the Holy Grail during the Middle Ages, they were Knights Templars. So there might be some truth in that.
All right. Thank you for calling in. Let's go to Wildcard Line Josie in Richmond, Virginia. What's your question for our guest?
Hi. Good to be on the program with you all. I have a book called The Holy Kingdom by Adrian Gilbert, Alan Wilson, and Baron Blackett. You probably have heard of it. They were looking for the real king author also. And they seem, it's been a long time since I've really looked at this book, but that there were two king authors, not one, that they, all the different legends got sort of intertwined there among the two men. And there was this business Avalon was maybe across the waters, maybe pointing towards United States, because they were secret places where you could buy the or find the copper and that you needed to make weapons with, and there might have been some kind of interaction between those the island of the Americas and the other island. So anyway, I thought you might want to comment on if you've heard of this book and this real the quest for the real author, and they have pictures in this book about places in Wales where they might have discovered some of the graves, gravestones, and so on. So, and they also...
All right, well, what do you make of that, Graham? I mean, you've heard quite a few of the other myths, legends, and lore. What do you make of some of those stories? Obviously, you believe that what you found is the actual story, and that's because of the uncovering of new archaeological finds. But what do you make of some of the past things that have come out? And thank you for calling in, Josie.
Well, it's very interesting about the Avalon being in America. One of the books I wrote, which was called Merlin and the Discovery of Avalon in the New World, talks about a second, as your caller just said, a lot of these legends got mixed up, and there was a number of places that were thought of during the Dark Ages to be Avalon. And although I say the original one seems to be an island in a lake, there is some. There was a book that was written in the Dark Ages that talks about Merlin. It's supposed to be a fictional book, but it talks about Merlin searching for Avalon across the Western Seas, and the journey he takes would appear to be an actual journey to America. It talks about going to an island on the way where there is water that shoots out the ground, which is boiling hot. Well, Iceland has geysers, and unless anybody had ever been there, they wouldn't know that. They also talk about a land where the seas appear green because of the rocks underneath. That is why Greenland was called what it is, because it had these green shores, if you like, and so forth. So it seems that somebody had written a tale about Merlin sailing to an island or a place far, far away in search of Avalon, traveling to Iceland and Greenland, and this story was written in around about 700 AD. Well, whether it's true or not that Merlin ever went in search of Avalon across the Western Seas, the fact is that unless somebody had made such a journey in an attempt to get to America and got back, they wouldn't have been able to describe what they described. And this is 300 years before the Vikings were the people known to have made the first journey. So, yeah, it's a fascinating story about the possibility of Avalon being in the New World.
Well, as you go further with your exploration and hopefully get to be a part of the archaeological dig for King Arthur and Excalibur, will you report back with us and let us know what's going on?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be fascinating stuff. I need to get permission to dig, but hopefully, before too long, I'll have the definitive proof that Arthur is buried where I say he is.
Great. Graham Phillips, our guest this evening, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, The Search for Camelot and the Isle of Avalon. You can find information about our guest at coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. During the break, go check out darknessevents.com and find out where you can meet me throughout the year. We'll be going off to the Oddfellows Asylum in Liberty, Missouri this coming weekend. And in June, we're off to Germany and Prague. It's an adventure of a lifetime. I'd love for you to join us. Check it out at darknessevents.com. Stay tuned. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.